Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14 is a very popular verse. I'm going to read Isaiah 7, 14, and then I'm going to ask for you to tell me what the prophecy is about and whom it relates to. And I'm going to wait because Jody's just frantic. Are you there? No? You're there? Oh, you get your glasses. Okay, yes. Isaiah 7, verse 14. Tell me if you know this verse. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. Who is this in reference to? Yeah, right. It's the standard answer. If you're not too sure what the answer is, Jesus is usually correct. You can throw that out there. Feel pretty confident in that. The Messiah, which is why we even sang Jesus Messiah. I came this close, but I wasn't too sure if we could pull it off. We were going to sing some Christmas songs today, because wouldn't that have been cool? I think that would have been a lot of fun, but I didn't want to throw people off too much. You know, we're just all coming together. Isaiah 7:14. This is one of these verses in the Bible that when we preach about it, especially at Christmas time, it regularly comes up, and it's regularly read, and we reference it to Jesus. But I've got a question for you. Is that the only prophetic element of that particular passage? Because the original hearers, the people living in Isaiah's day, would they have known that it was a prophecy about a coming Messiah who was going to be born of a virgin? Probably not. This one is one of these weird passages because, out of curiosity, do you know Isaiah chapter 7, verses 1 to 13? Have you ever read those? How about verse 15? The reason why at Christmas time we isolate Isaiah 7:14 is because Isaiah 7:13 and Isaiah 7:15 are extremely confusing, and you read that and you go, that doesn't sound like Jesus. And that's the reason why we don't read it to you at Christmas time, is because it really doesn't fit very well in the Christmas motif. And I have always had an issue with Isaiah 7:14 and it being preached, which is why I was very excited. This was actually one of the major prophecies that caused me to really want to do a sermon series like this, is because what did the original prophecy really mean? I have never heard a sermon preached on Isaiah 7:14 that included the rest of the chapter. In fact, I've never actually preached a sermon on Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, that included the rest of the chapter, which means this is all really exciting for me because we get to cover it today. The hard part, and probably one of the reasons why it doesn't really show up at Christmas time, is the extended political difficulties of the day have caused people to just shy away from it. But you guys are fantastic students of the Word. You are ones who enjoy some of the historicity of passages. And so today we're going to dive into the historicity, the historical context of Isaiah chapter 7. And it's going to be weird because as we study it, especially with the political climate of the day, you might say, it sounds a little too close for comfort, because I think there's definitely a lot that mirrors our own society today. So to help us understand, we got to get a little bit of geography. So we're going to set up the sanctuary. The sanctuary, we're going to say, is facing north-south. So you guys are all looking north. And at this time, the nation of Israel had been split into two. There was a civil war that took place, and it got split up into two, the north and the south. So the northern kingdom got known by two different names. They're known almost exclusively as Israel, but also it was known as Ephraim, which was the largest state of that time. So Israel and the northern kingdom, and they were ruled by a series of kings leading all the way up to 722 BC, when finally God brought judgment in the form of the Assyrian army, and the northern kingdom was wiped out. The nice part about studying the northern kingdom is it's really super easy to find out if the kings were good or bad. Because in the north, all the kings of Israel were bad. Every single one of them. They're all bad. So Bob, you're going to be the king of the north. Yes, because Bob is always bad. So your name at this particular time and place was Ahaz. Is that right? Yes, I got to be careful, make sure I get this correct. No, sorry. You are Pekah. You are Pekah. Sorry. Ahaz, so you're Pekah. You got that? King Pekah? Good. Awesome. Now, the northern kingdom was relatively large. If we looked at the land, it took up about two-thirds of the space. So we're going to... You guys are pretty evil. So we're going to go right here. All right. Here's the border line right here. And this then became known as the southern kingdom, almost exclusively known as Judah. All right. So Judah is the southern kingdom. The hard part when you study the southern kingdom is the kings were a mixture of both good and bad. So, Gary, will you be my king of the south? All right, your name is Ahaz. Now, was Ahaz a good king or a bad king? You're not too sure. He sounds good. I mean, he looks nice. You know, he seems like a good... Ahaz was a bad king. Ahaz was a bad king because he was rather brutal. In fact, we know from the Bible that one of the things that King Ahaz did was he sacrificed his son in the fire. And what that would mean is they would put statues, usually of a god named Molech, and they would build these kind of ornate altars and statues out of stone, and it would be over a natural fire pit, like earthen lava flow, heat, steam. And what they would do is if you wanted to sacrifice your kid to the god of Molech, you would take the infant and you would place it on the heated stone, and then the child would just burn up. So, is he a good king or a bad king? Would this be appropriate for a Christian to engage in? This is a person of God would never actually do that, but that is what King Ahaz has done. Now, the problem is, up until now, the king of the north with Pekah and the king of the south, Ahaz, they'd been conquered and had a vassal occupation from the Assyrians. Now, the Assyrians are all that way for quite a ways. They had been conquering a whole lot of stuff. The king of Assyria was a guy by the name of Tiglath-Pileser. Is that not the coolest name ever? Jacob, I'll give you $20 if you name your first kid Tiglath-Pileser, because that's just, man, is that just not brilliant? Tiglath-Pileser. Pronounce that with me, Tiglath-Pileser. Exactly, something like that. So Tiglath-Pileser had come in, and they had taken away all of the rights of the kingdom, but also the kingdom that was directly north of them was the Arameans. So now the Arameans were not part of the covenant relationship with God. They were just a northern kingdom, and the king of Aram was a guy by the name of Rezin. So that's when you're looking at Isaiah 7. His name was Rezin. So this is what happens. In 735-ish BC, Tiglath-Pileser has just kind of come to power. And this was a great time because the best time to attack a foreign oppressor is right at a regime change. So what happened was the king of Aram said to the king of the north, Bob, because Peak is too hard to remember, Bob comes to Bob and he says, Bob, let's make a coalition and we're going to join together and we're going to fight against the Assyrians. Does that sound like a good idea? Now, were the Assyrians good or bad? They were all bad as well. So this is the problem we've got. We've got the evil Assyrians. You've got the Arameans, who are not part of the covenant relationship with God. You've got Bob, the king of the north, who didn't follow after God. And you've got Gary, who's the king of the south, and he's not following after God. So essentially, no one's following after God. This is the context of Isaiah 7, and this is the reason why it's... Does this sound very Christmassy to you? I don't want to sing joy to the world at all when I, Handel's Messiah, for unto us a child is born. This isn't very Christmassy. So the king of Aram, the king of the north, say, let's bond together and we're going to fight the Assyrians. But they know they really need to suck in the king of the south, Gary. So Gary, they come to Ahaz and they say, Ahaz, we are going to band together and fight off the Assyrians. Guess what Gary does? Gary hops onto Twitter, hashtag Assyrians, there is a coup that is about to be started, and the Arameans and the northern kingdom are all banding together to fight you, so can you please come and help me out? Because what he essentially says to Bob and Rezin is, we're not going to join. So all of you in the southern kingdom, just stick out your tongue to the northern kingdom. Yeah, do the sound too. You can do that. You have just all been told, we're not going to join your little coup. Now the problem is, Bob, what do you think about your brothers not joining in to fight off the evil Assyrians? Yeah, well, this is the, so now the king of the north and the king of Aram realize that how do we attack the north with Assyria? Because from the south, they could come and invade. So you know what the king of Aram and Bob, you know what they end up doing? They decide, well, if you're not going to join us, we're going to kill you. Isn't that a great idea? So everyone in the northern kingdom, turn around and shake your fist at the southern kingdom. You guys aren't very good at this. Come on now. Yes, there we go. Yes. You hate them. Your brothers, isn't it weird when people of the same religious persuasion end up having internal fights about things? So this is what's happening. So the northern kingdom now hates the southern kingdom, has told Aram, we're going to join in and we're going to go ahead and attack the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom, again, on Twitter, is trying to get the Assyrians to come down and help. But the problem is, how long will it take for the Assyrians to get here? It's going to take a little bit of time. And the problem is, they're about to fight. So let's see if we can get the political culture here. The north is bad. They've essentially abandoned God. The south, mostly bad. You're led by a king who is super duper evil. And then you've got the Assyrians who are super bad. So the question is, who should you align with? Do you ever ask yourself this question? Who do I align with? Do we have any good choices? Sometimes we get to the point where like, well, there's this one and this one and this one, and they're all kind of bad. And so who do we trust? Who do we rely on? Who do we put our trust for what's going on in our life? This is the political culture. So the problem is, then Ahaz decides to try something a little funky. He's going to see if he can find out what God thinks of this. Now the problem is King Ahaz really a godly man? No, he's not a godly man whatsoever. He has no problem sacrificing babies on stone idols. So he is really not following after God, but there is a prophet that happens to still be following after God. And that prophet's name is? Yeah, it's the book we're in, Isaiah. Very good, yeah. So Isaiah, this is the culture that we're in. So Isaiah chapter 7, verse 1. Wow, we're going to be here for a while, aren't we? No, we're not. Don't worry. We'll get through it. We'll get through it. We'll get through it. When Ahaz, that's Gary, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram, that's the Arameans up north, and Pekah, that's Bob, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, northern kingdom was known as Israel, marched up to fight against the Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. So now we've got the problem. The two kingdoms here have band together to kill all of you in the south. Now the house of David, which is the southern kingdom, when this area was told, Aram has allied itself with Ephraim, so the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. So you guys are scared. Because do you see how small you guys are? You're small in comparison to the northern kingdom and then banded together with Aram. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son, Shear-Jashub, almost as cool as Tiglath-Pileser, Shear-Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the water washerman's field. So the aqueduct, this was ways to bring water in, and there was a certain area called the washerman's field. It was kind of this extra aqueduct that came off the main aqueduct that supplied the food. And what do you think they did in washerman's field? Very good. Or if you're from the south, they washed. Right. So this is where you're cleaning your clothes. So Ahaz is out there. Gary's out there washing his clothes. He's a responsible man that, you know, he can wash his own. You can wash your own clothes, right? Yeah, so he's out there hanging out. And Isaiah and his son, Shear-Jashub, go to meet him. Say to him, so this is now a prophecy directed straight towards the king of the south. And say to him, be careful. Keep calm, and don't be afraid. So far, so good. Is this a good prophecy? Yeah. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and of the son Aram and of the son of Remaliah. So God is saying, look, Bob and Rezin, they're smoldering fire sticks. They talk a lot, but they got no game. They act like they're going to come down and blaze through your towns, but in my opinion, they're just simply smoldering pieces of wood. Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah's son have plotted your ruin, saying, let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart and divide it among ourselves and make the son of Tabeel king over it. So they've already got a plan. They've already told Gary, Gary, we're going to kick you out, and we're going to make this king of Tabeel, he's going to be the king over it. What do we know about Tabeel? Nothing. We have no idea who he is, what he's like, nothing. Yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. It will not take place, it will not happen, for the head of Aram is Damascus. That's the northern, sorry, the Arameans, their capital is Damascus. And the head of Damascus is only Rezin, the king. Within 65 years, Ephraim, the northern kingdom, will be too shattered to be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, that was the capital city, and the head of Samaria is only Remaliah's son, Pekah, a.k.a. Bob. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. Now we turn to our own lives for a brief moment to see if we can understand a little bit more. Have you ever gotten yourself into a situation, maybe because of really stupid choices that you've made, maybe because of alliances that you've made with people who are less than holy, or maybe you've made a deal with the devil. A lot of people are like, oh, I don't ever make deals with the devil. I think we make deals with the devil all the time. Things like, I won't disturb your kingdom, you just don't disturb mine. We make deals with the devil all the time. And do you ever find yourself then in a situation that is essentially unworkable? Have you ever been backed up against a corner where all the choices you now have left to make are all bad? Have you ever found yourself in that way? I think we all have some sort of sense of that. Maybe you're in school and you didn't study very well for the test, so you decide to do something a little unholy and you cheat on your test, but the problem is the professor finds out. Now, what choices do you have left that are going to be good for you? If you confess, what's going to happen? You're going to get punished. You're probably going to get a zero. Your grade's going to be reduced. So that's a bad choice. Or do you dig your heels in and continue to claim innocence even though the professor knows that you've cheated? What would be the punishment of that? You might get expelled. You know, it could be even a whole lot worse. Do you see the difficulty that you might find yourself in? Or a teenage girl gets pregnant outside of being married. What are her choices? She could abort the child. Would that be a good choice? That's going to be bad. There's going to be some really bad consequences that are going to happen to her in her life. What if she decides to give the child up for adoption? She's going to, it's still not good. I mean, it might be like a better choice, but it's still really hard because the mother is going to have this really big challenge of letting go of a child. And what if the teenage girl decides to just go ahead and raise the child on her own? Well, is that a good choice? That could be tough. Is she going to end up having to drop out of school? She's going to be a teenage mother. She's going to feel the ostracization of her friends and her family. So because of the choices she made, she ends up now in a whole lot of trouble. Or you're a guy who has decided to finally, after all these years, snap back at a really nasty boss. The boss is just, he is unworkable. Like you cannot, but you realize I've got to have a job. But then there's one day the breaking point comes and you just go off on him. Now you're in trouble, right? Because what are your choices? You can apologize, but what will that do? Not much. Maybe the boss will still fire you. What if you say, you know what, fine, I don't care. What are you going to go home and tell your wife? Honey, I screamed at the boss today, and I kind of got fired. Now, what is the wife going to say? Stupid. There might be some other choice. The problem becomes, what do you do? Do you see how this is a lot like what we go through on a regular basis? We make choices that are sometimes less than holy, and we end up in situations where all the choices that we have before us are all bad. So what do you do? Who do you trust? Who do you rely on? King Ahaz, he could have said, you know what, we're going to go it alone. We're going to fight. I think maybe it will call up the Assyrians and see if we could do something. You did have one other trick up your sleeve, which was really cool, which was the people to the south. People to the south were all the Egyptians. And just so you know, it actually did happen. You sent a message to the Egyptians, and the Egyptians said, sure, we'll come and help you. So they start marching north, and then the Assyrians find out, and they start making a beeline towards the Egyptians, and the Egyptians go, oh, my bad, so sorry. We were just out for a stroll. They turn around and leave. So now all of a sudden, the southern kingdom's really in trouble. You're all alone. All you have is the unholy alliance you have with Assyria. And so you ask Assyria, can you please help me fight, but then don't come and kill us? They've made a deal with the devil. Come and save us, and just don't kill us. And God then comes in and says, I've got another plan. He's reminding them, stand firm in your faith, or you will not stand at all. And this is where I think sometimes we get off track. We start thinking of all of the plans we got to come up with. We got to figure out, maybe we need to do this, maybe we need to do this, maybe we need to do this. And sometimes I believe God comes in and says, how about you do this? Trust in me, and I will take care of the situation. But how many of you like that as an option? It's good. I mean, I think we can look back and normally see that typically God comes through in those situations, but is it really hard to trust at that time and in that place? It can be very challenging. So Ahaz, really not buying it too much. Isaiah's saying, stand firm, be strong, be in the faith, you're okay. And then Isaiah gets a message from God, because I'm thinking God is whispering to Isaiah, he's really not getting the message, you're going to have to help him out a little bit. So he says to him, verse 10, again the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. So Isaiah gives King Ahaz, you get a free shot. Come up with something so that I can prove to you that I am still in control, I'm still in charge, and I still will make sure that everything is okay. So what would you come up with? That's not a rhetorical question. I'm just curious. If God wanted to come to you and reassure you of something, of his incredible faithfulness and his depth of love for you, and you wanted a tangible sign right here, right now, what would you ask for? Leroy. That's great. And you want it to drive, like, maybe right in front of you? Yeah. Lord, make a, was it Ferrari or Lamborghini? Ferrari with a Christmas tree strapped on the top. Because is that, like, do you often see? What if Leroy said, I want to see a white car drive in front of me? That would be a stupid sign, a Ferrari with the Christmas tree strapped. What else? Yes, Jacob. Like, I want an angel in all of his glory and splendor and majesty to come and levitate right through the roof and come right here and go, hello. Would that be good? Oh, yeah, that's right. Sorry, standard angel protocol. Do not be afraid. Yeah, fear not. Yeah, sorry, that's right. SAP, standard angel protocol. Yeah, that would be a good. Okay, Joshua? A unicorn with a top hat that is farting rainbows. Of all the things that I thought I was never going to say during a sermon, I think that might be it. Out of curiosity, have there been other times when God has offered to people, I will show you a sign to show you my faithfulness? Are there other times in Scripture when that's actually happened? The Old Testament things, he's a little bit difficult. He did it with one guy. His name was Gideon. Gideon was a scared guy. And so Gideon said, God, I'm gonna throw out a fleece, which is where we get that phrase. I'm going to throw a fleece on the ground. And what I would like to have happen is that I would like the fleece to be wet and the ground to be dry. I think it's that one. Yeah. And so what happens is the next day he goes out, the fleece is wet, the ground is dry. And then God, and then Gideon says, God, I don't want to be a bother, but can you help me out? One more sign, do it in reverse. Make the ground all wet, but the fleece be bone dry. And so God does that. He does it to another king a little bit later on. There's a king, he's on his deathbed, and the prophet comes to him and says, I am with you, and you are not going to die. But he's like, I'm sick. And when you get sick back in those days, you normally die. And so, no, God is going to heal you. But all these people are coming in, and they're like, paying me well wishes, like, oh, it was really nice knowing you. Isn't that kind of a scary thing if you're an older person, and people are like, it was really nice knowing you, Mike. You'd be like, wait, no, I'm still breathing. Like, what's going on here? And so this guy's like, but you know what? I'm going to recover from this. And he says, yes. And I will let you choose a sign. You can either look at the sundial and you can make the sundial go forward 10 spaces or backwards 10 spaces. And of course, the guy being savvy goes, well, going forward 10 spaces is like normal. That's just time progressing. Can you make time go in reverse? Would that not be a crazy sign? Almost as crazy as farting unicorns. And so God says, fantastic, this is a sign, I will give it to you. So now this seems like a wonderful thing. King Ahaz, I want you to come up with a sign, any sign, because I want to verify and show you this, I am with you. You do not need to side with the Assyrians. You do not need to join the unholy coalition of the Arameans in the north. You do not need to rely on the Egyptians because guess what? I'm gonna be with you. I will take care of you. And you just ask for a sign and I'll prove it to you. And guess what Ahaz does? He turns on what we all know is false piety. He says, oh, I would never put the Lord your God to the test. Because doesn't that sound like holy? Now, first of all, is Ahaz, how astute is he in the Scriptures? He's astute enough to know that, yes, there was no less than 9 places where God says, don't put me to the test. The only thing is, when God comes to you and says, put me to the test, he actually says, go ahead and put me to the test. Does it with giving. Give to God and I'll put it to the test, and I'll show that I'll open up the floodgates of heaven, and I will provide for you. Put me to the test. 10 steps forward, 10 steps backward. I will provide. But Ahaz is realizing if he trusts in God, he's going to be in a very difficult position because he would rather either align with Assyria, align with the Arameans in the northern kingdom, or align with Egypt. And the problem is aligning with God is just not too much fun because now you're no longer in control. And who here loves to be in control of their own life? And so, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. Then Isaiah said, in a probably stern, firm, semi-angry voice, "Hear now, you house of David! Is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign." All of a sudden, it's like we soften it. No, no. I think this would be angrily. You know what? Fine. Then the Lord himself is going to give you a sign. And you know what the sign's going to be? The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will be called Emmanuel. God is with us. That's probably how it was. Is this a good prophecy or a bad prophecy for the first persons listening to it? It's a bad prophecy. What he's essentially saying is, you're trying my patience, and you know what? Fine, you don't ask for a sign. I'm going to give you a sign. I'm going to show up personally. I'm going to show you what's going to happen. The virgin is going to conceive and give birth to a child. And again, some people argue about, you know, well, the word in the original Hebrew is not virgin as in like a literal virgin. It's just literally a young girl. But again, that would be a lot like Leroy asking for a white car to drive in. Hey, a girl is going to get pregnant. Shocker. Girls get pregnant all the time. Like, that's not exciting news. But if a virgin conceived and gave birth to a son, now that would be news. In the kids' church, it was funny because Heather and I love to talk about what she does with the kids, what we do over here. And in their opening activity, so ask your kids this when they, you know, when you're hanging out, what your kids learn. Because this was the scenario. Imagine you were in school and it is nearing the end of school, and you're about to go on to summer break. And you're about to start when all of a sudden the teacher steps out of the room for a little while. And of course, you guys all have, I know you would never do this, but you guys have idiots in your classroom that all of a sudden start acting up. And they're like, "Hey, the teacher's gone. This is cool. Let's do whatever we want." And you're like, but, you know, we're about to go on break. And all of a sudden, the teacher comes back into the classroom. Now, the teacher coming back into the classroom, is that good news or bad news? It depends upon what choices you've made. If you are the idiot who is starting to act up and do a lot of crazy stuff, all of a sudden the teacher coming in, it's bad news. But if you are anxiously awaiting the teacher to return, and you're excited about it, then the teacher returning is good news because finally the teacher will put into place all the people who are bad. This is the context of therefore a virgin will conceive and give birth to a son. I'm not going to go into long details about this, but I'm going to tell you how I believe the original prophecy was fulfilled. I believe the original prophecy was literally fulfilled in a literal virgin giving birth to a literal son, and that child having some sort of concept of its name being Emmanuel, and that it was going to be a prophecy of judgment. Because if you look, the word Emmanuel shows up only 3 times in all of Scripture. Isaiah chapter 7, 14, its fulfillment later on in the book of Matthew, but then in Isaiah chapter 8. And as you may or may not know, Isaiah chapter 8 follows Isaiah chapter 7. Did you know that? This is the reason why reading context and figuring this stuff out is really fantastic. I had a discussion with a pastor who asked me, "Well, what do you think the fulfillment of Isaiah 7:14 is?" I said, "I think it was a double fulfillment. Did it involve Jesus? Yes, but at first it involved Isaiah's own child. Because in Isaiah chapter 8, he goes to the prophetess. And you can Google it. I did, and of course, Wikipedia, which we know is a very reliable source of information, has told me that Isaiah chapter 8, the prophetess, almost all scholars agree, this is Isaiah's own wife. And it says in Isaiah chapter 8 that he goes to the prophetess and she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said to me, name him Mahershalal Hashbaz. But then when you skip forward, it says that this is what's going to happen. As this child gets older, soon Assyria is going to come down, and Assyria is going to take out the Arameans, and Assyria is going to take out the northern kingdom, and then Assyria is going to come and take you out because you didn't follow me, and the waters are going to go right up to your neck, and you're going to be thinking, I am going to drown. And when he comes, as I come, oh, Emmanuel. It's actually there. You look at it, Isaiah 8. The end of verse 8, O Emmanuel. And sure enough, just so you know, that prophecy did come true. Because in 722 BC, the Assyrians came down, wiped out the Arameans, and then came and found Bob, killed Bob, took over the northern kingdom, and then decided, oh, hey, you know that bond we had, the little contract that we weren't going to, you know what, no. No, we're going to come down and kill you too. And they started taking over all the towns, all the cities, everything except for one place, which was Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is now surrounded by armies. And now they are about to die. The floodwaters are going up to their neck. And they're not too sure what to do. And the prophet comes and he says, you don't need to worry because you know what? God has made a promise that you will be safe and you'll be secure. Just trust in him. Not even an arrow will be shot into this city. Not one arrow. And sure enough, in 701 BC, as it's being besieged, people trust in God, and they pray, and they repent. And that night, an angel of the Lord comes through and kills 185,000 Assyrian foot soldiers in one night. And the king, whose name was Sennacherib, it sounds like snack on a rib, yeah, retreats. Now, the interesting thing is when you look at secular history, guess what they said, Sennacherib, do you know the reason why they said Sennacherib retreated? There was a plague of rats, and in one night, 185,000 people died because a plague hit. Really? You can die from a plague in one night because a rat bites one Assyrian foot soldier? They're all dead. They're all gone. And God makes a promise. So what does this mean for you and I? So that's the context. I think it actually happened. But then the nice part about it is us as humans, we have made choices, very poor choices throughout our life that have led us into situations that are not very good. And we wonder to ourselves, I think I made poor choices. Does anyone here have any regrets in their life? Okay, good. I love it when people proudly raise their hand. I have done some of the stupidest things in my life. And when I talk about my regrets, I hate sharing my regrets because I am honestly and truly utterly embarrassed of some of the ridiculously stupid things I have chosen to do. Some of that regret and shame that I still carry around even to this day. I don't want to share it in front of you because I really don't want to bleed all over you because I know that you have the same shame. You have the same guilt. You have the same struggle because of dumb things you've made. And God says, you know what? I'm going to come and be with you and I'm going to provide for you a sign that shows you just how much I love you. There is going to be a girl, a virgin, and she will conceive and give birth to a son. And we find out that that's exactly what happened with Mary, giving birth to a child. And when Jesus came, the floodwaters were right at our neck. We were about to go under. Our stupid choices had led us to things that we didn't really enjoy. And we might be saying our lives are over. We say that so often. I hear that from so many people. The choices I make, my life is now over. And God says, your life is not over. You will make it through. Why? Emmanuel, I am with you. And you do not need to carry around the shame. You do not need to carry around the guilt anymore. Now is the time to start shedding that skin and standing before God and saying, God, I need you. God, I repent of my sins. I have made dumb choices. I'm not going to hide it anymore. I simply want to follow after you. And I made a mess of my life, Lord, but I trust that you are still going to be with me. And God says, I will be with you. And then God did other things. He turns water into wine. He feeds thousands with a kid's lunch. And then most importantly, he died and came back to life in the ultimate sign that showed just how much he loves you. And this is the message we have as Christians. God's coming again, and the question will be, what will we think of it when God shows up? Shall we be excited? This is why I really wanted to sing, you know, Joy to the World, the Lord has come, because it's actually, as Mr. Strupp had pointed out several years ago, that song, Joy to the World, was originally written about the book of Revelation, about the second coming of Christ. Joy to the World. Who here would be excited if Jesus showed up today? Oh my gosh. Because I don't know about you, I'm kind of up to my neck. I sometimes feel the world's up to its neck. I sometimes feel like everything's spinning wildly out of control. You know what God is saying the whole time? Don't trust in the northern kingdom. Don't trust in the Arameans. Don't trust in the Assyrians. Don't trust in the Egyptians. Don't trust in anything in this world that is unholy and not of me. Instead, do one thing and one thing only. Trust in me. And that's my encouragement for you. As this wild and wacky life spins out of control, as your life spins out of control, stop and say, Lord, be with me. And he will. Let's pray. Father God, we have made a mess